Accession number 12708, Mr. R.W. Hawksworth, Reel 24.
Mr. R.W. Hawksworth, Reel 24. What were the duties of a Sergeant Major at the base depot?
Well, regimental depot, the main task there was to train our recruits. We reverted to regimental training of our own recruits by this time, and ringing in my ears, the last word that Crackers Maid said to me in Egypt was, "And whilst you're there, teach the buggers how to play football." Company commander at that time was Major Collingwood, as I remember, a one-time most popular officer who received severe wounds in the Battle for Sicily. The daily routine, supported by three excellent platoon sergeants, instructors, and their corporals, two per platoon, were the training recruits. Basic training for some 6 weeks. Sergeant Clouston, Sergeant Duckworth, and Sergeant Breinhoff, who later became a Lieutenant Colonel, were my sergeant instructors at the depot, who supported me 100%. It was a great job, a responsible job, and one which I enjoyed 100%.
These would be national servicemen, were they?
We were taking in the last dregs of national servicemen. That's not the proper thing to say, I suppose. National service was about to finish, and so I suppose we trained the last squads who were national servicemen. And even at that time, we were getting an increase in volunteer regulars. So there was a mixed bag.
Did they gel together, this mixed bag?
Oh, we didn't believe in segregation at this stage. As the recruits were documented, having arrived in their civilian clothes and long hair, we allocated them to platoons in rotation, so that one platoon may have had more national servicemen than regulars and vice versa. But we ran three platoons, each of whom had a battle on the name, and this, was to encourage competition, healthy competition. I supported 100% by the company commander, Major Collingwood, insisted on including at least once every afternoon some 1.5 hour of sport. This was not a voluntary situation. Every man jack under training, including the instructors, would take an active part, not a sideline spectator job, at some form of football. And happy to say, I even found time to train the cross-country team.
How long were you there?
I was there 2 years. 2 years was the expected tenure, and I fulfilled the contract. I stayed there 2 years, and at the end of which, I read an invitation, an Army Council instruction, calling for a voluntary warrant officer to serve in the Oman, out in the Persian Gulf, and I was seriously considering applying for this post. In fact, after a couple of weeks, I had made up my mind. I thought I was coming to the end of my service anyway, and I thought I'd just like to have a look at somewhere where I'd never been before, although it was another bloody desert. And so I successfully applied to go out as a warrant officer too. Sometime later, I was involved in a drill parade on the square when Major Darcy Irvin, who was commanding the depot, called to me across the square. When I doubled across to meet him, he introduced me to no other than General Furbank, who was at that time Director of Infantry, who introduced himself and said, I believe you are going out as a company sergeant major to the Trucial Oman Scouts. I replied in the affirmative, and he said, well, you're not. You're going out as a regimental sergeant major, which, of course, booked me up no end. Eventually, my term of office at Bransforth finished, and for a few short months I rejoined the battalion at Barnet Castle, who by that time had been placed under orders for active service in Cyprus, which was suffering a certain amount of turmoil. Pressure was brought to bear from various sources upon me to cancel my application to join the Arab force, but I considered I'd honour my application, having accepted and promised no less than the general that I would take up his offer. Eventually, I was taken out by Royal Air Force to the Omani coast, where I met the full Colonel John Carter, who was in charge of the Trucial Oman Scouts, whose main tasks were to intercept and detain and destroy drugs and their runners, combat slavery, and build up a force worthy of the Emirate.
How did you find the region when you arrived?
I found out in a short space of time that that's where the flies come and go from. The weather out there, as people are experiencing it, is extremely hot. The nights are cold, not as cold as the Western Desert, but I've never been in a hotter place in my life. Stepping into the Persian Gulf for a swim is like getting into a tepid bath. I enjoyed the tour there. I learnt basic Arabic. I introduced something that was sadly lacking, and that was a proper passing out parade system, which pleased the commanding officer no end. And generally speaking, I got all around the desert. We had at our disposal certain Royal Aircraft, Royal Air Force aircraft, which bore our crest of cross daggers. And I flew on occasion down to Aden. I flew to Bahrain on occasion. I visited Daz Island, which was at that time finding oil off the Persian Gulf coast. I visited Muscat and lots of other interesting places. I never regretted my 12-month service out there, and when my term came to leave, although I was glad to get away from the heat and the flies, I was sorry in a way.
What was the quality of the men that you were training and were going into the Scouts?
Well, the recruiting area, or the recruiting arrangement, was the crudest. These chaps would appear from nowhere. As one can see from the map, the town of Sharjah, where our regimental quarters was based, lay south of Abu Dhabi and Dubai, and then there's a vast empty quarter until you get up to Qatar and Bahrain. Most of our recruits, or potential recruits, came from the south of the Arabian Peninsula, a true Arab, a real Arab, not a crossbred wog with a fez. We also had chaps who came across in the dhows, the traders' dhows, which fly between the Persian Gulf Coast and the mainland of India, or Pakistan, as it's called now. And so we had a mixed bag. Not all were accepted, and at odd times we were infiltrated by troublemakers who managed to get up from the Aden area. I need not explain the situation down there at the time. But generally speaking, we had a special intelligence officer with us who spoke all the various dialects fluently, and he sorted the wheat from the chaff. And I reckon out of 100 applicants, we would take 20. Where the remainder disappeared to, God only knows.
And what was the quality compared in your own experience with British troops that you'd worked with?
The chaps who were selected to be trained were equally as intelligent as myself or anyone else. They were human beings, and although some of them had never even been to school and couldn't read or write, they rapidly became acquainted with the working parts of a rifle and a machine gun, and latterly mortars when our heavy stuff started to arrive. I'd like to point out that at this stage, this force, the True Shalom and Scouts, was in fact the nucleus of the Emirate Army, as it is to now, the Royal Emirate Army, I believe it's called. So, obviously, I had a hand in setting this up. The officers in charge of squadrons, as we call them, and not platoons, it came from any regiment of the British Army. My instructors were drawn mainly from the Guards Battalion. By fair means or foul, I eventually replaced them by chaps wearing the light infantry badges from the Cornwalls or the Durhams. And the most interesting aspect of the whole business was Colonel Carter's first instruction to me was, I want them to be taught to be light infantry Arabs. And so light infantry drill was introduced, and light infantry music was produced on tape and records. And they marched at 140 to the minute.
Were they mobile?
We had transport. We had Land Rovers, long wheelbase Land Rovers, fitted with desert tyres, which were extremely efficient, I might add. And we had larger trucks, similarly equipped for use in the desert. We also had a camel patrol, which I stood away from most of the time, for obvious reasons. But as I say, the force was in its infancy in those days, although we also had a boys' unit. We had some 30 boys under instruction at that, in those days, and it was good stuff. The daily routine, of course, varied from our usual arrangements. We had a reveille at 5 a.m., and parades finished at 11 a.m., Then there was a compulsory attendance at a sport of some description between 4 and 5:30 every day.
Was it the same sports as the British Army?
Yes, definitely so. We had an RAF attachment with us of some 50 bodies who had Shackleton bombers under their control, but under our direction. And I sought and gained permission on numerous occasions to accompany these aircraft on their forays over the desert when they were engaged on seeking and sorting out the infidels who were hiding amongst the mountains.
But your role was training. It wasn't going out and doing this work.
No, my role was strictly regimental sergeant major's role, drill and discipline, and in order to strike out in a new direction. Occasionally, I would accompany the RAF people, or possibly visit one of the squadrons. One squadron was based in Sharjah, one squadron was at Barami Oasis, which was about 80 kilos into the desert on the Saudi border, and we had another platoon to the north at a place called Liwa, who were in the only part of the desert I'd ever visited which actually had sand dunes.
I think you said you were there a year.
Yes.
Was that the end of your contract?
That was the end of my contract, yes.
What were they paying you for this?
Well, I got normal regimental sergeant major's pay, but on being on secondment to this force, I got a Foreign Office supplement. I can't remember the details now, and certainly at that time I wasn't bothered. Much to my surprise and pleasure, towards the end of my service, I received information from the paymaster in England that I had some £650 in the bank, which, unknown to me, had accumulated during my service with the Scouts.
Where did you move to when you returned to England after being in Scouts?
Well, I came straight on to Bransworth, which was still our regimental depot, and was told that the role of company sergeant major, or the positions in the battalion in Cyprus, were filled, and I realised it would have been grossly unfair to dislodge a warrant officer in order to replace me. So I decided to remain at the depot awaiting instructions. Eventually, I was asked if I'd like to proceed as an instructor of the Shropshire Light Infantry, who were based in Colchester. I agreed, I joined the 1st Battalion King Structural Light Infantry in Colchester. I stayed 12 months with them as a weapon training officer, and then joined for the last 3 years of my service the 4th Battalion Territorial KSLI, where I took up a similar role. I eventually was discharged honourably on the 13th of the 11th, 1961.
The discharge procedure, what was it? How did they finish with you, in effect?
Well, I was caught nearing the date. I knew I was due for discharge. The chief clerk in the orderly room sent for me and said, "You know, you've only got a month or so to do." And I said, "No, I didn't know it was as quick as that." I might add at this stage that I'd already been given an extra year's service. They asked me if I wanted to have an extra year. So I'd been granted an extension of a year. Had they asked me if I wanted another 10, I would have accepted. But this was against the rules of the day. So I was informed that the procedure had been set in motion, the wheel had been set in motion for my discharge in the not-too-distant future.
Did you receive a final medical?
Oh, yes. The medical officer at the depot in Shrewsbury, that Sir John Moore Barracks, gave me a final check-out and said, "There doesn't seem to be much wrong with you. What are you going to do in Civvy Street?" And I said, up to that time. At that time, I'd registered my liking to become a military instructor at some famous public school. And in fact, I received several written invitations, both from Marlborough College, Winchester, St. Margaret's in Jersey, St. Paul's in London, and one or two others. And you can't remember what's more important than that. But by that time I realised that the proper thing to do was to make a proper break, a clean break with anything military. I found a job possibly at home. I was still as yet unmarried. And I thought the proper thing to do was to go home and live in a month at a time. So having decided upon this, I thanked these other people in the schools profusely, and told of my change of heart. So I came home and registered as an unemployed ex-soldier and immediately got a job as a driver for a security firm.
Had you... did they kit you out in a civilian suit?
No. That was in the old-fashioned discharge. No, I kitted myself out rather smartly. Of course, I'd received my terminal grant payment, or golden handshake, whatever you like to call it. So I spent the last few happy weeks in Shrewsbury, tinged with sadness, I must say. And on my last day there, I was trundled out in a local bricklayer's barrow wearing a bowler hat.
You would, of course, receive a permanent pension.
Oh, yes, I was certainly pensionable. I'm received from then, of course, and now, a long-serving one officer's pension, which would grossly amount to something in the region of £90, one-third of which, however, the Treasury people seized. Nevertheless, I'm grateful for the monthly or the weekly remittance, which I think I earned.
So you had a pension, then you said you had, in your own words, the golden handshake. Was that a payment for so much for so the years that you'd been in the army?
Yes, I think as it worked out, similar to most big reputable firms, it was what is called a terminal grant. So many a pension, your pension accrues according to your rank and coupled with the length of service, and this terminal grant is based on the number of years you've served, not necessarily in any particular rank.
What was it difficult to settle down to civilian life after all these years in the forces?
I decided to make a break, as I previously said, but I found it difficult for the first few months. I'd got a job. I was fortunate in that respect. I was driving an armoured car for Security Corps, one of the original drivers. And in the evenings, I was filling in time doing a bit of a bank guard job. but I had previously registered with the Customs and Excise in one of their security branches, and eventually a post became vacant. So in February 1962, I joined HM Customs and Excise in Hull, shortly after which I met and married my present wife, thank goodness, and I served with the Customs in Hull, my hometown, for the next 23 years.
And when did you retire?
I retired in 1985, having served certainly 23, I think it was 23 years and 20-something days. Almost the same length of service as I did with the Army, which was 25 years and 25 days or something like that. So I had not much spare time since I joined the Army.
Have you kept up your connections with the regiment?
Yes, certainly. I attend the regiment reunions. I had a lapse at one time due to the commitments at work when I was at sea on the customs cruisers, but I now attend regularly the reunions at Durham annually in September. I'm the chairman of the Hull branch of the Light Infantry Association. I'm a member of the Gateshead Newcastle branch of the Durham Light Infantry Association. And I'm also a recently accepted member of the Fellowship of the Services, belong to the Beverley branch, which is near Hull. So, and apart from regimental connections, I'm the secretary of the local bowling club.
The regiment is the Durham Light Infantry is gone now, and you were a member for so many years, although you are, as you say, a Yorkshireman. What are the qualities of the Durham soldier, in your estimation?
I think the first thing that springs to mind is tenacity, toughness. The Durham Light Infantry man, whether he comes from Yorkshire or his home county, seems to get involved with the tradition, and I think tradition's got a lot to do with this. The Durham Light Infantry man comes from a family who in the early days were called skirmishers. I'm going back a few years now, but these chaps had to run around rather quickly, used as interference people, as far as the enemy was concerned, lightly equipped and with little or no food. And therefore, they had to be tough. And I think, although they all didn't come from Durham, this is one of the traditional reasons why certainly the light infantry men as a whole have a reputation of being tough. But the Durham Light Infantry man, as far as I'm concerned, is an exception. Apart from which, anybody that had to go at one time down a deep coal mine to earn his living, a hard, dirty and dangerous task, and work awful bloody hours, had to be also tough. You had to be tenacious. And this is the sort of spirit that's inherent and related to the regimental tradition. I know any self-respecting regimental soldier would say similar things about his own regiment, but I refer to forewords written by, once again, General Bernard Montgomery, who said if he had to choose a battalion or regiment on which he could rely 100%, it would be the Geordies, and that's good enough for me.